Welcome to Midday on WNYC. I'm Kai Wright. And before we start the show today, I want to acknowledge the tragic breaking news unfolding in Texas. Yet another school shooting in Santa Fe, a city just southeast of Houston. Details are still emerging, and WNYC will be following the story, as well as that of the Lincoln Tunnel bus collision, throughout the day. I don't have those details here, and we're not going to cover the news in this program, but we send our thoughts and our prayers to the families who may be touched by this recurring insanity. And with that said, we're going to turn our attention to another important conversation, and that's the cost of healthcare in America. It's happened to nearly all of us. You get a medical bill after a doctor's visit, and you have no idea what you're paying for or why you are paying so much. And that is not because you are dumb. It is because America's healthcare system is one of the world's most convoluted and least economical, particularly when you think about how much we spend on healthcare, about $33 trillion per year. Elizabeth Rosenthal is a Harvard-trained doctor who became a journalist to cover the healthcare system. Today, she joins me to explain how we got here and how you can take more control over your own health budget. Her book is called An American Sickness, How Big Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Elizabeth, welcome to Midday.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, later in this conversation, we're going to want to hear from you as well. We want to know about your medical expenses and how you are cutting them. If you have questions that Elizabeth might be able to help answer, give us a call, 212-433-9692, or tweet us at @MiddayWNYC. So Elizabeth, let's start, before we get into sort of the nitty-gritty of the details of cost today, let's start by getting some background. When did the concept of health insurance even become popular in the U.S.? Where did this start?
Well, it started in the last century. And of course, as treatments got more refined and more expensive, it made sense. The beginning of the last century when health insurance started, it was a hospital for $5 a day or something like that. But basically over time, and especially after World War II, it became a benefit that employers liked to offer because they weren't at that time allowed to offer salary increases. So, you know, we've kind of married employment and insurance. And then over time, you know, in the 60s, older people were having trouble accessing increasingly expensive medical care. So then we have Medicare, and then we have Medicaid. And now, you know, we have this patchwork system trying to deal with a hugely, hugely complex and expensive medical industry, and it's just not doing a very good job for anyone.
And that's interesting to just underline the point that this, the idea of our health insurance being tied to our employment, that started in the post-war era as sort of companies were trying to deal with labor costs, right? And it led to a massive increase in the number of Americans who were insured, right?
Yes, and each of these steps did. And, you know, I like to say this is a classic case of the road to hell being paved with good intentions. You know, as we expanded insurance, that was good because people weren't able to access health care as it was becoming more expensive. But it led to this chicken and egg problem where when more people have insurance, they feel like they're not really paying for it, right? So the inflation of healthcare prices just goes crazy. And now we're in an era where we're facing high premiums, higher deductibles, out-of-pocket expenses, and we are paying. So now we're all going like, oh my gosh, how did those prices get so crazy? And that's what I'm trying to address.
Well, and another thing that we take for granted this idea of insurance and we think we're not paying for it, but we also take for granted the idea of the medical industry as a for-profit enterprise rather than a social service. But that also, when did that happen? When did that change? That wasn't always the case.
Well, no, and that's really why I wrote the book, because I wanted to understand how, I trained as a physician in the 80s and 90s. So, you know, then there was still this real sense of mission, and the doctors and the nurses were in control. But over time, in the last 25 years, it's been kind of usurped by financial interests. So now, what are the metrics of a good healthcare system? You know, is it profitable? What's its return on investment? Should we buy a new machine? Well, will it make us money? so those ideas are on the front burner. And hey, is it good for health? Is it good for people? That's kind of moved to the back burner, and that's what I want to reverse.
Right, and that's, you say that happened in the 90s. So that's about the time when we saw the health insurance premiums start to skyrocket as well.
Well, in the 90s, really, it, I think, escalated in the early 2000s when, you know, many hospitals that were kind of struggling in the 90s, there was this little bump of HMO activity, and hospitals were struggling to figure out, gee, how can we stay solvent? You know, they were in some kind of trouble then because the payments weren't that high. And they brought in a lot of consultants from McKinsey, Deloitte, the usual, you know, the usual companies that said, hey, you can make a lot more money just by billing more effectively, just by thinking about healthcare as a business. And so they said things like, gee, you know, you have someone lying there in the recovery room for an hour and a half. Those are billable minutes. Why are you giving
right.
that away?
Right.
And so every little thing, you know, the Tylenol, the oxygen that goes in your nose, you know, the ambulance ride by the mile, by the minute, becomes a billed service. And that, in part, is what leads to all these outrageous right. bills. And the second part of the problem is when you get those outrageous bills, they often just say things like $10,000 miscellaneous. So you don't even know how on earth they're coming up with these prices.
I'm speaking with Elizabeth Rosenthal, who is both a doctor and a journalist, the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News, and her book is titled An American Sickness, How Big Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. So let's talk about those bills, Elizabeth. I mean, most of us feel like, or many of us at least, think there's some logic behind the numbers we're seeing, but it turns out they're pretty arbitrary, actually, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, basically, one of the rules in the book is prices will rise to whatever the market will bear. Mm. And when you can't see the price of what you're paying for, you can essentially pay anything. So here at Kaiser Health News, we did a story last week. We're doing this Bill of the Month project with NPR, where a woman who asked for an itemized bill for some foot surgery discovered that the four tiny screws in her foot were each being billed at $3,000 apiece, even though someone told us the manufacturing cost was maybe $30. So the manufacturer marks it up, the hospital marks it up, everyone, you know, runs to the bank, but this poor patient is left with $15,000 in bills for tiny little screws. And whether she or her insurance is ultimately paying that, we all pay for it.
Right. And can you explain the idea of upcoding, for instance, as one of the things
sure.
that happens on these bills?
Yeah, I mean, you know, everything on bills is not in plain English, which is one thing I think we need to change, you know. So even if I ask for my bill, I'm often going to get this compilation of codes and abbreviations. So how can I know if it's right or wrong? But coding is kind of the language of medical billing. And so what upcoding is, and you know, upcoding itself is technically illegal. It's trying to bill for a higher degree of service than you actually gave. But a lot of hospitals will teach doctors how to do what I would call enhanced coding. So they'll say, for example, one of the doctors in my book said, you know, we got these coding classes and I saw a kid with a hurt foot and they said, gee, you know, if you just listened to his lungs, you could have coded for a level 4 visit instead of a level 3 visit. And that would have meant another $100. And the doctor's like, yeah, but he didn't need his lungs listened to.
He's here for his foot.
Right. So, but the business of medicine is driving coding. It's driving charting. It's driving so many things that have nothing to do with our health. And I think we could get much better value if we pulled back and focused on what's medically necessary.
You said something there I want to catch. You said that this doctor in particular had a class on coding. So is there being taught how to enhance code?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is part of almost every hospital system now. There are coding classes. There are specialized coders who do just eye surgery and know, like, all the tricks to maximize your reimbursement for what you do. And then the hospitals themselves, because they're judging their doctors on their, you know, that work metric, productivity, which means, of course, billing, they'll say to their doctors, here, we're going to give you coding classes so you know how to maximize reimbursement for what you do and maybe do a little more in order to maximize reimbursement. So, you know, and the doctors I speak to just hate this. It feels so undignified. And, of course, it drives up medical costs and leaves patients with out-of-pocket expenses.
But the idea is because we're asking you to be, we're judging you by your productivity, we're going to show you how you can be a little more productive in the numbers.
Yes. And in many hospital systems, actually, your salary is tied to how, quote unquote, productive you are, meaning your billing. So, you know, there are a lot of really terrible, perverse incentives going on if you're looking at healthcare as a social good, or even as a business whose intent is primarily to do some good things.
Right, or to provide you the service you actually need as opposed to just selling you random things.
Right. And I think what cuts this kind of practice short in other things is that people see accurate bills. You know, you go to get your car fixed, you get an estimate that's accurate, and you see, you know, how much did the carburetor cost? How much did the wheel cost? But you don't have that right in billing. So it's kind of, we're told, oh, you know, patients should be good consumers. Well, great. How on earth can I even start that? And that's, you know, that's part of what I want to tell people. There is a way to start that. And I want to encourage everyone to act like you have consumer rights as you would in every other part of your life.
Well, and we'll talk about some specifics that you've got on how to do that. I mean, let's think about tests, for instance, you know, blood tests, radiology testing. What do I do as a patient? I go to the doctor, you know, and they say, listen, you need these tests. You're not sure if you do or not. How do you react? I mean, I think about I went in for a stomach ache. I wasn't feeling well. And they were like, well, either it's the flu or you have cancer. We can test for it.
Right.
You know, how do I respond to that? I'm going to take the test, right?
Yeah. You know, I think it does put a burden on patients to have your antenna up all the time. Like, why are you doing this? But I think, you know, put them up a little bit. So things that I do, for example, if my doctor says, you know, you need a blood test, what you can do is many doctors' computers are programmed to send that blood test to a hospital lab where it will be hugely expensive. So you can say, okay, give me a requisition. I'm going to walk it down to the street to, you know, a commercial lab like Quest or LabCorp, where they'll give me a price quote and say it's going to cost $7 instead of literally $700 at the hospital lab, perhaps.
I can say to my doctor, hey, listen, okay, draw the blood, but give me the blood. I'll go get it tested.
Yeah, or just send it to this lab. They can do that. Or you can say, you know, if you need an x-ray, say to your doctor, and part of this is working with your physician, you need your knee x-ray. Okay, physician, send me to the center near your office that will do a good job, but will do it at a reasonable price. And the first time you say that, your doctor will go, oh, I have no idea how much they're charging. But I think it's every physician's job right now in this environment to say to the doctor that's charging $150 for an X-ray, okay, you can get my patients. And to the one that's charging $1,500, I'm not referring patients to you anymore because you're ripping them off. And a lot of people have high deductible plans. So that $1,500 is now coming out of my patient's pocket. So if I'm a responsible physician, and I know this is a big ask for physicians too, I have to guard my patient's health as well as, you know, protect them from extortion.
Elizabeth, we have someone on Twitter who asks about recent denials by insurance companies for claims using the ER. Is that something that's happening? Why is that happening?
Well, you know, there's always we want to discourage unnecessary care. And there's always been this narrative that, hey, people use the ER when they should be looking for a primary care doctor. Often we know that's not possible. And often you don't know as a patient if it's an emergency before you go to the doctor, like you're scared, right? Before you go to the ER. So there are some insurers that have tried to say retroactively, we're going to say, oh, this wasn't a real emergency, so we're going to deny it. Now, this is where I think voters and state regulators And your employers have to push back because it's a really big burden. Okay, if I have like a little splinter, maybe I shouldn't be going to the ER if it's at a time of day when there are other things. But if I have really bad stomach pain, I don't know if it's appendicitis or the stomach flu or something that'll pass in an hour. So I think we are seeing state legislators and employers pushing back on that, saying, no, you can't deny those claims. And I urge everyone to fight them. Another common ER kind of scam or the thing that happens is you go to an in-network ER, right? You take the trouble to go to an in-network ER. And it turns out that the doctors there are out of your network. And so you get big out-of-network bills from the doctors. That's bonkers, right? You go to an in-network ER, then everything there should be in-network. Now, a bunch of states, including New York, have laws now saying that if you're caught with those kind of surprise medical bills, you don't have to pay them, that you send them back to your insurer and to the provider and say, you guys work it out. To me, the ultimate answer, and this is why in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, I wrote what I call a patient bill of financial rights, is that if I go to an in-network hospital, if I make the decision and take the trouble to do that, everyone who touches me in that hospital has to be considered in my network. Don't throw it back in the patient.
Briefly, before we have to go to a break, Elizabeth, the part of the point for the Affordable Care Act, though, was in fact to discourage ER visits, right? In the sense that they are, and it is the belief that they drive up the costs so much. How do we think
and
about
that? Well, there are certainly a lot of inappropriate ER visits, and there are people who use the ER inappropriately. And, you know, frankly, as a former ER doctor, it's pretty easy to see the difference between someone who's really, really scared and worried and could have something bad and someone who's just, you know, oh, it's easier to go to the ER. Mm-hmm. And I would point out that going to the ER is not a pleasant experience.
No, it is not.
You wait a long time. So I don't think there are all these people who think, wow, I could go to urgent care or I could go to the ER. I'm going to choose the ER. I think part of the problem is we don't have a lot of good outpatient alternatives for a lot of people, like other than going to the ER. You know, you don't, a lot of the freestanding clinics, maybe they don't take your insurance, they don't take Medicaid, they're very expensive. So, you know, I think in order to if we want to like say how much inappropriate ER use is there, we also have to say, which was part of the Affordable Care Act, we have to build up that primary care system so there are good alternatives. And in many parts of the country, the ER is it. That's all that's left.
You're listening to Midday on WNYC. I'm talking with Elizabeth Rosenthal, author of An American Sickness, How Big Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. We're going to take a short pause for the cause and we'll return to this conversation and take your calls about medical expenses. So stay with us. This is Midday on WNYC. I'm Kai Wright, and I'm talking with Elizabeth Rosenthal, editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and author of An American Sickness, How Big Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. And Elizabeth, we want to get to the second part of that subtitle, how we can fix this thing as a society, but also as individuals. And you know, and listeners, we want you in this as well. If you have questions about your medical expenses, how you can cut costs, please tweet us at Midday WNYC or call 212-433-9692. So yeah, Elizabeth, thinking about how we can fix this thing. Help us think about medical devices for a second, because that's one of the that's one of the things we don't really think a lot about. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. And I think, you know, what the book is actually, it's called An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business. We think of it as big healthcare because it has become so powerful and we feel like we have no power, but we can do a lot. So, you know, medical devices is a funny category because it's totally inward facing. Like, you don't know how much your hip implant costs. Your doctor will pick it. The hospital will mark it up as much as they want. So that's the kind of area where we are going to need some outside help. Every other country sets some kind of price on what it will pay, what its physicians and citizens will pay for those artificial pieces that go inside of us. We don't yet, and I think that's something we need to consider. So you'll see that a hip implant that might cost $3,000 in Belgium will cost $12,000 here. Mm. Okay, you know, we need to do something about that's hard individually to do. But there are other things you can do, and I think everyone has to do. For example, shopping for prescription drugs. If you look at a site like Goodrx.com, you can see the prices are all over the place, even at pharmacies within a few blocks of you. Also, I tell everyone, you know, if it's a longstanding prescription, maybe you want to consider mail ordering from Canada, or when you're in Europe, buying a few. You know, it's fun. There's an amusing story in the book, which is sad as well, of a guy, a blogger from Washington, D.C., who paid for his trip to Paris by picking up his inhalers for his asthma in Paris, six of them, which were $300 in the U.S. and 30 euros in Europe. So, you know, you can use these strategies. You can also use them for things like, you know, it's just you have to be aware when your doctor says, hey, you need to have this procedure done, and says, what day is it easier, Tuesday or Thursday? Well, that could be really significant. You think of it as just, wow, it's what day of the week. But maybe on Thursday, she operates at the hospital, and on Tuesday, it's a surgery center. Huh. The facility fees will be double or triple at the hospital. So again, it's about feeling empowered to ask those questions. Like, does it make a difference in the price? How can I get this drug cheaper? Is this drug, are there cheaper variants available? And you should go back to your doctor and say, hey, doc, I went to the pharmacy to fill this, and they told me it would be a $200 copay, and it's a $1,200 drug. Your doctor may not know that. There's a story about in the book about a drug called Duexis, and an accountant who did just that. And he discovered, and I discovered with him, that this drug was just a combination of two over-the-counter drugs that he could have gotten, you know, do-it-yourself for about $11 a month. And so, you know, it's hard, but we do it in every other aspect of our lives. And right. It's about asking questions. You know, when you go to buy a car or a refrigerator, you don't know that much about what's inside, but you know that you're entitled to ask questions about why is this one better? And we all have to start doing that with our healthcare as well.
Let's try to see if we can answer some of our callers' questions as well. Let's go to Leah in Long Island. Hi, Leah. You're welcome to Midday on WNYC.
How are you? Hi, Dr. Rosenthal. What's the best way to deal with a doctor or your insurance when you realize you've been upcoded for a medical procedure? I'm actually dealing with something very similar right now with a doctor who coded a scope procedure I had and two follow-up visits, each as three separate surgical procedures. So it seems like my doctor is getting not only reimbursed by my insurance company, which, you know, is a whole separate problem, but, you know, it's also resulted in a copay for $150 for each visit rather than my regular copay visit. So how would I approach this? Because it's almost like trying to prove the negative, and I also want to maintain a relationship with this doctor.
Right. And this is often the challenge that people face, because they don't want to, if they like their doctor, they don't want to piss them off. But I think you just what I do is, you know, be very straightforward. You write in or call in and say, hey, this was one visit and I don't understand why it was coded three times. You can ask your employer if you have an employer who has an HR troubleshooter to make that call. And I think often, you know, the physician is not the one who's doing the billing. They're outsourcing this to a billing service that may, you know, that's trying to generate income. So you and the physician were the only two people in that room and know what happened. So if you say, hey, this didn't happen, I hear from so many patients that they'll go, oh, okay, you know, we'll take that charge off. Sorry. Now, I think the problem that upsets me is this is a persistent problem with some offices and with some billing services. And instead of being considered like, wow, this is kind of fraud, people go, oh, yeah, sorry, you know, we'll just take that off. But for the moment, and to protect yourself and to protect your company from unnecessary outlays, I think it's always good to look at these bills and challenge them and say, hey, this didn't happen.
Okay, so if I already approached the billing manager in the doctor's office and they said, well, those visits were coded as surgical procedures, and that's what they were. So do you think the next step is to speak to my actual doctor?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think, and I think, you know, it doesn't have to be a hostile conversation. It's, you know, I'm concerned about the way this was build and make them understand. I think a lot of doctors are still operating in an era where they don't realize that their patients have these big out-of-pocket costs. And, you know, maybe they're kind of, it's one thing to think, oh, yeah, the insurance company is going to pay out a lot. But they, you know, they don't want their patients being harmed.
So you're just straightforward but firm. Leah, thanks for that call. We have a bunch of folks calling in with questions, so let's try to move through some of them here. Steve in the Bronx. Steve, welcome to Midday in WNYC.
Thank you for taking my call, and Dr. Rosenthal, thank you for your articles and your book. This is a question about a patient who's admitted to emergency room and then is an inpatient for necessary medical treatment. The patient, a day or two later, feels better and feels that the person could go home and be treated, if need be, see the person's own doctor, is told that that person's leaving AMA, and afterwards, the person goes home, does feel better, doesn't need to go back to the hospital or see a doctor. The bill comes in, the hospital tries to get reimbursed by insurance. Insurance will not pay for it because they say it's in connection with either noncompliance or leaving the hospital against medical advice, even though the treatment was medically necessary, the person complied, and it was done before leaving the hospital.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the kind of thing, again, you need to fight back against. In the book, I do have some kind of Mad Libs-like form letters to complain about issues with hospitals. And it's helpful because I've used them. My colleagues at the New York Times use them because it kind of it points out which buttons you have to push about your rights. And this is a classic example of something that I think a lot of us get stuck in. You know, they'll say, oh, we can't discharge you. It's the weekend. And it's not because you're not ready to go, but because there's some administrative problem. And then guess what? You're billed for those two weekend days. So, you know, I would just make the point very calmly that that the patient had a necessary procedure, checked out AMA because it was done, had no further issues, and therefore any bills beyond that are not your responsibility. And, you know, dig in your heels.
And
that's
Elizabeth,
all I can say.
From a preventive perspective on that is, I mean, how do we look ahead as in that moment and stop it? Is there anything we can do?
Well, I think you could talk, you know, in theory, it depends how, what the kind of relationship you have with your doctor and the hospital. You know, maybe you could say, I don't want to sign out AMA. Let's talk about, will you let me go home? But often they may say, no, you know, you can't. Yeah. So I think, you know, there are issues like this that come up with ambulance rides. You know, when an ambulance pulls up and says, we should take you to the hospital, you have to have in your mind going, you know, what's this going to cost? Is it in my network? Right. You have to, there are places where you can be proactive and preventive. There are places where you just can't. And there are a whole lot of places where you shouldn't have to be, but in this medical system, you do.
You do.
So, you know, when you go into the ER and they say you have an emergency appendectomy, what are you going to do? But I still tell people, you know, ask, is that anesthesiologist in my network? Because if you don't ask, you can get stuck, right? And you know, you'll have someone from billing saying, oh, sorry, but, you know, you owe us $6,000 for the anesthesia.
And it returns to your point about transparency. So, for instance, we have a number of callers saying that offices will not give them estimates for surgery costs because they don't know what the procedure is going to entail. What does a patient do in that moment?
Well, I think this is something that we as individuals and our legislators have to push for, that, you know, having accurate estimates is considered a right in many hospitalization is considered a right in many other countries, in Australia, in South Africa. These are countries with advanced medical systems where it's considered a right. Here, either there's like, oh, well, how can we know? Well, guess what? you know what it generally costs, and we know there may be a little variation, but tell us what Medicare pays you for this service. That's a fixed fee. Give us a ballpark and have it be accurate. You know, I get letters from people that are appalling where it says, yeah, I asked for an estimate. I pushed and pushed and pushed. They told me it's going to be $4,000, and now I get a bill for $20,000. I would say not okay to that. You know, that's, again, fraud. We need accurate estimates. And yeah, sometimes on estimates, hospitals may take a little bit of a hit, just like contractors when they tell you how much it'll take to renovate your kitchen. Sometimes they make more, sometimes they make a little less. But they know this and they need to provide this to us.
But we know with contractors, if your price goes up, you know, 400% or whatever that was, that in the example you were just using, you'd say, oh, well, this is a shady contractor. We won't use
right.
them again.
This is shady. And P.S., you know, the hospitals know when you're going in what your insurance is likely to pay. That's what computers can do, right? They know what your responsibility is likely to be. But no one demands that they give us that information. And so I think one of the patient bill of rights, one of the rights on that I say is, you know, an estimate, an upfront estimate in advance that's accurate. And that is doable, but there's not the mass patient pressure or political pressure to have to do it at the moment.
I'm speaking with Elizabeth Rosenthal, editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and author of An American Sickness, How Big Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Let's go to Lori on the Upper West Side. Lori, hello. Welcome to Midday on WNYC.
Hi. Thank you for giving me a chance to speak. I'm a physician. I'm actually an anesthesiologist, and many of the points you've been making are need to be said and are very well taken. But I want to explain some of the problems on the other side. The insurance companies know who they're dealing with. And what they're, and from that I mean, they have to have hospitals in their network, and they have to have physicians in their network that will bring patients to the hospital. So that means that they'll give reasonable reimbursements to surgeons, to internists, but the people that are hospital-based, like anesthesiologists, pathologists, and radiologists, often are reimbursed at a much lower rate than they would normally want to accept, because the insurance companies realize that they have you over a barrel. And on top of that, there are antitrust laws that prevent all the physicians from getting together. I'm lucky enough to be at a very large academic institution, and when managed care first came in, we were able to get the physicians, all of them, to come together and say, okay, none of the surgeons say will accept an insurance policy if they weren't willing to give the anesthesiologists and pathologists reasonable rates, and that's worked well for us. We're totally unable to negotiate with Medicare because Medicare just tells us what we're going to get. And they also, we can't refuse to take Medicare. So what Medicare has done is the insurance rate that Medicare reimburses, say the surgeon, is around 60% to 70% that of what they would get from the rates that they've negotiated with private insurance companies. For the anesthesiologists, we get 1/3 of the rate, of the insurance rate that insurance companies are willing to pay us. So if the insurance company were going to pay us at $80 a unit, Medicare often pays us at $20 and $25 a unit because they know they have us over a barrel. How can we mobilize people to help us?
Well, I think, you know, this comes into the larger question of what physician work and hospital work is worth. I mean, Medicare would say they're paying everything at cost plus, you know, so they're building in a profit into those payments. Of course, commercial payers will often pay much, much more than that. And you know, the question is, what's the right amount? And I think we haven't figured that out. But yes, I understand that anesthesiologists and those ancillary doctors are often feeling over a barrel. But now it's really the patients that are over a barrel when physicians and hospitals and insurers can't agree on what the right amount is because the patient gets left holding the bag. And I would say, you know, one thing that infuriates me in terms of the anesthesia issue is if I go to a big hospital in New York or elsewhere and say one of my kids needs outpatient elective surgery or elective surgery, and I say, make sure the anesthesiologist is in my network, they'll say, we can't guarantee that. And I'm like, I don't get that. You know, I don't assign the anesthesiologist. I don't know which of your anesthesiologists take my insurance. That should be the hospital's responsibility. And I get that, you know, some doctors are undervalued, some doctors are overvalued. It all depends on the bargaining power of the group, whether it's the anesthesiologist or the anesthesiologists and surgeons, or whether it's the whole hospital. It's all about bargaining power. And I think that's really kind of messed up because more and more it's the patients who are left holding the bag at the end.
So we've just got about a minute here, Elizabeth, but zooming out, we have to talk about the Affordable Care Act in this context. Yeah. What did it achieve in terms of costs coming down and what didn't it achieve?
Well, it did some really, really important things. One is to say that people with pre-existing conditions have a right to affordable health insurance. It also laid out some general kind of concepts about we should try and get everyone insured or get everyone good health care. What it didn't do, unfortunately, was its moniker, right? The Affordable Care Act. It helped make insurance affordable to a bunch of new people, to tens of millions of new people, but it also has not controlled the much broader and much more complex problem with high-priced healthcare in this country that affects everyone from the poorest to just up to the 1% probably right now.
So more people can get it, but it's still just as expensive.
It's cheaper for some people and more people can get it. But some of the insurance plans that are being offered now are so, you know, you look at Charlottesville, Virginia, the premiums for a family of four, $3,000 a month with a high deductible plan. That doesn't really help you. That's before you've even used your health care. Right. You've spent $40,000. So we really need to make affordability a meaningful concept for health care.
I've been talking with Elizabeth Rosenthal, editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and author of An American Sickness, How Big Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Thanks for joining us, Elizabeth.
Thanks for having me.